I was supposed to give a talk on Monday, and I was unable to. And thankfully, my friends, Marion and Lisa and Mary Baga, filled in for me and gave the talk for me. And I'm told by people who have heard my talks that it was much better without me than when I actually give my own talks. And so I'm going to adopt that as a plan going forward. And we'll be sharing this talk with two colleagues. Ariel, who was just introduced, and Christina Gebel, who's a student of mine at BU, who's been working with me on a project for the last year, and we've built this into it. This is from Listening to Mothers, and essentially what we wanted to do, I'll talk a little bit about Listening to Mothers, but what we wanted to do is track some trends over time, because we've now done three Listening to Mothers projects. We have no financial relationships with commercial interests to disclose. These were the three Listening to Mothers surveys, so we've been doing them now since 2000. Well, the planning started in the 90s, but since 2001 and 2002 was the first. We did another one in 2005. We did another one this past year that encompassed the dates of the years of the births of the mothers that we were dealing with. You see the variation in the number of participants. We've been able to increase sample sizes across the 3 years of the three surveys. The methodologies have changed somewhat across these, and we've been able to do a follow-up survey after the second and the third of these surveys that focus on postpartum issues. We went back in the field 6 months after the survey to look at mothers again. The Listening to Mothers 3, most of the data we'll present is the trend data. We'll occasionally present something specifically from Listening to Mothers 3, the most recent of the surveys. It's conducted by Childbirth Connection. My colleagues, Carol Sakala and Maureen Corey, are the core of this project. It was funded by W.K. Kellogg, bless them. We surveyed 2,400 women. It's not, we weren't shooting for an exact number like that. It just worked out that way. 18 to 45 years old, singleton births in hospitals. The reason we don't do home births, we don't do multiples, is because the numbers are so small, it wouldn't be a significant enough group to do an analysis on. And so we kept focused on singletons and hospital births. But keep that in mind as you look at some of the responses. The data is adjusted to reflect the target population, combination of both the nature of the sampling and weighting done by Harris International, Harris Interactive, who conducts the surveys. And this is just one of the findings. This is mothers' experiences of selected interventions, and this is from Listening to Mothers 2. And you can almost barely kind of see the trends in a number of these different interventions. Note that for a moment, hold on to that, and then let's look at Listening to Mothers 3. And the reason I wanted to show this was one of the themes of this is the rates of intervention have generally gone down. In most of the areas we were talking about, the number and rate of interventions that we're dealing with in areas like use of intravenous, multiple vaginal exams, catheters, episiotomies have for the most part gone down on a pretty consistent basis between Listening to Mothers 2 and Listening to Mothers 3. So there's a tendency for us to work in the sort of area of childbirth to constantly bemoan the rise of interventions, and it's heartening to know that in some of these cases there is movement in the other direction. I think Christine is going to take it up now with childbirth education.
Okay, thank you to Jean and also to Ariel. So I'm going to start with talking about childbirth education trends. We might have some childbirth educators here in the audience, so we thought it would be a topic of interest. We're particularly going to look at primates and multips. So for primates, we see a substantial decrease in the uptake of childbirth education across the three surveys. And with multips, we see a decrease in 2005, but then it kind of stabilizes back to the rate that it was in 2001. And then for multips who took childbirth education during their previous pregnancy, the prior one was their current pregnancy, we don't have those numbers for 2001, and we see relatively the same percentages across the last two surveys. So like Jean said, we're going to pull out some findings and specifically talk about Listening to Mothers 3, which was the most recent survey in 2011 and 12, and they also had a follow-up. So childbirth education class participation. So on the far right, of all of our mothers, we see that 34% of the entire sample took childbirth education in their current pregnancy. And you'll see vast differences between primips and multips. The primips, it was 59%, whereas experienced mothers, only 17% took childbirth ed in their current pregnancy. We flip that and we say, okay, well, what about in your prior pregnancy? For experienced mothers, 83% did not take it, not in a current pregnancy. And then for mothers who had never taken classes at all, we have an overall rate of 47%, meaning they had not taken childbirth ed at any time. So 53% had and 47% had not taken childbirth ed at any time. This slide is often a favorite in that it's very interesting and fascinating. The cascade of intervention is a term that was brought about in research in the 1980s, and it's been an area of interest in surveys like ours and data like ours. So I kind of want to go through this. I want to mention that our base is first-time mothers with term births who experienced labor. Okay, so that's the mothers that we're going with, and that was about 750. So we separate that into those who had an induction and those who did not have an induction. So follow me on the right side of the screen as we go with mothers who had an induction. So 47% of those mothers of that subset did. Of that group, 78% had an epidural. And of those mothers who had an epidural and an induction, the unplanned cesarean rate was 31%. If you go to the left side of the screen, under mothers who did not have an induction, 53%, of that group, no epidural was given to 39% of those mothers, and then the unplanned cesarean rate was only 5%. So you can kind of just kind of mull over the contrast there on the both sides of the screen. And the reason that we put it in this framework, this cascade of interventions, is because the idea is that having one intervention, particularly in this case induction, increases your likelihood of other interventions as well. And on the bottom, it's probably hard to see, but it says in this group, which included 85% of first-time mothers, the overall epidural rate was 69% and the overall cesarean rate was 21%. So we're also going to go through some trends in mode of delivery, and this is all survey participants in their respective year. Spontaneous vaginal birth, we see it kind of hovering around 60%. For forceps or vacuum extraction, we see a dip in 2005, but then kind of stabilizing back to its 2001 rate of 11%. For cesarean section, you know, the rate of cesarean section being very high interest, in this field, we see a significant increase between the first survey and the second, however, a stabilization of the rate in the final survey. And then also pressure from a caregiver to have a cesarean section, which Arielle is going to talk a lot about kind of pressures and attitudes around these interventions. We see a slight increase from 2005 to the final survey in 2011 and 12. Another slide of interest, maybe these are just my favorite slides and I'm kind of interjecting my thoughts, which I apologize for. But with the rise in cesarean section, you know, we go through a lot of theories and hypotheses about, you know, well, why is it? Why is it raising? And some people might say, well, one is women are demanding it. They, you know, don't want to labor, and they come in and they say, I know I want a cesarean, I'm ready to plan it and set the day. So the base is primary cesarean births, and we're looking at those who had a planned cesarean that the mother initiated with the understanding that there was no medical reason. So essentially, quote unquote, maternal request. And we're seeing that this is not a contributing problem to the rising rate. We have less than 1% in 2005 of mothers who chose this, and then 1% in 2011 and 12. We're also going to talk about vaginal birth after cesarean. I imagine most of the audience is familiar with VBAC, but these are women who have had one prior cesarean and intend or desire a vaginal birth after that. So in the VBAC rates, with the base being having a cesarean in the past, We see 26% in 2001, 11%, a pretty substantial dip in 2005, and then a slight increase in 2011 and 12. Okay. And then on the next table, with the base of having cesarean in the past and for the most recent birth, we looked at attitudes. You know, was she interested in the option of VBAC? And we see, you know, 45% and a slight increase to 48% of mothers were. They were interested in this option. However, the last row did not have the option of vaginal birth or VBAC. We see 42%, an increase to 52%, and then a further increase to 56%. So these are mothers who did not have the option of a vaginal birth. Vaginal birth after cesarean. Okay, so why didn't they have the option? So let's talk about accessibility. You know, our base is it had a cesarean in the past and did not have the option of a VBAC for their most recent birth. Okay, well, is it unwillingness amongst the provider? So that seems to be going down, 36%, an uptick in 2005 to 45, but then substantial decrease in the third survey to 24%. Well, did they not have the option because the hospital was unwilling to do the VBAC? We have 12% in 2001, you know, again, an increase in 2005, and then back down again in the third survey. But what's interesting about this is actually the third row. It was a medical reason unrelated to the prior cesarean section. So then we think about, okay, well, if the caregivers seem to be more willing and hospitals seem to be more willing, are we framing it in a different way? You know, you can't have a VBAC because you have this medical indication. And if you look at the rates, I mean, 38% to 20% in 2005, and then over, that doubles, more than doubles, in the last survey in 2011 and 12. So having a VBAC, is this a repeat slide? Oh, I went the wrong way, I'm sorry. Okay, breastfeeding and formula distribution trends. So we're also interested in intention to exclusively breastfeed. Many of you might know that exclusive breastfeeding is a goal in the Healthy People 2020 and increasing breastfeeding rates in general. So we actually see a decline, 67% to 61% to 54%. So a decline in intention to exclusively breastfeed. Well, what about 1 week after the birth? How many, you know, what percentage were feeding the baby exclusively breast milk 1 week later after the birth? And we also see a decline in that too, 58% down to 50% in the most recent survey. So then we say, well, why? You know, like, let's think about formula. You know, are they supplementing with formula in the hospital? Are they providing free samples of formula? So we see those, both of those things going down from 47% to 38 to 29 for hospital staff providing formula or water to supplement breast milk. And then we see a huge decrease in the free samples of formula, which has kind of gotten a lot of buzz in the media, from 80% to 66% and all the way down to 49%. And then I'd like to hand it over to Arielle, who's going to talk about induction of labor in her first slide.
Thank you so much, Christina and Jean. And I will just point out that I was the executive assistant at Childbirth Connection. Maureen Corey is the executive director there, where she does a fabulous job. Here we're looking at induction of labor trends over the last year, 10 years or so. They haven't changed tremendously. We see about almost half of all women have an attempted induction of labor. And for about a third of women, an induction causes their labor to begin. Now, this is actually a lot higher than what vital statistics show. Vital statistics show a pretty consistent induction of labor rate at around 20%. So what our findings suggest is that the prevalence of induction of labor is actually quite higher, and that depending on birth certificate data is not always very reliable and underreports these types of medical interventions. And we feel confident in saying this because of the weighting of the data to make it nationally representative with the stipulations that were mentioned earlier. Okay, so here are some of common reasons for induction of labor, and seeing as the induction of labor trends have remained fairly static, it's not surprising that for some major reasons the rates have also not seen much meaningful change. Unfortunately, we weren't able to include all of the reasons that we asked about for why women had an induction, because in the last survey we changed some of the wording of the question options to improve clarity. So while we felt that those are better results, they weren't necessarily comparable over time. But it is interesting to note that 44% of mothers said that the reason, noted a reason of their induction was that the baby was full term or overdue. So, excuse me. And they were also directed to select all that apply. So the answers are non-exclusive, and we didn't identify a primary reason. Here are some other trends, maternity care practices and interventions. I'm trying to speed up because we're running out of time. But we see that for eating and drinking in labor, that's on the increase. A lot of hospitals have policies restricting eating and drinking during labor so that in the case of an emergency cesarean, the idea is to prevent further complications. So what these trends suggest is that hospitals are either becoming more permissive with these policies or women are simply more so choosing to ignore them. We also see decreased rates of episiotomy and labor augmentation, which is great, especially with the labor augmentation. That's a really big decrease, which, you know, we like to see for the most part. But what is troubling is the increase of women who are giving birth lying on their back, when research shows that non-supine positions of giving birth, such as squatting, lying on one side, or even standing, can contribute to more optimal maternal outcomes. So this is just from the last survey, and it just shows that pain medication is still very much the norm for hospital births in the United States, with about 2/3 of women opting to have an epidural, and epidural is by far the most common choice. It's more than 4 times the number 2 option of narcotics, and less than 1 out of 5 women will go pain medication-free in labor. So the trends here aren't completely consistent across the board, but if we just choose to focus on the difference between 2005 and 2011 and 12, we do see promising trends in terms of lower rates of epidural and higher rates of using no pain medication. For narcotics across the board, they've gone down a lot. And an interesting finding is the increased use of nitrous oxide for pain relief. Nitrous oxide is not widely used in the United States, but it is used a lot more in Great Britain and Canada, and it offers a lot of benefits to laboring women. It's immediate pain relief. It can be used up until the time of labor, and it does not affect a woman's ability to push. So the fact that it's doubled since the last time we took the survey the second time we took the survey in 2005 is a really interesting and promising find. So now we're looking at drug-free pain relief methods. This is just from listening to Mothers 3, the last most recent survey. And here it says that this is actually pretty similar to how it was in 2005 as well. The only exceptions being application of hot or cold objects to the body or shower, which were increased, but less than 10 percent points. But for all the others, as it says within the note, it was within 5 percent points. Okay, so as Christina mentioned, I was going to talk more about pressure to have a medical intervention during labor. excuse me. So across the board, all mothers report feeling between 13 to 15 percent of them report pressure to feel one of the major interventions that we've talked about, labor induction, epidural, and cesarean section. But when you look at the difference between the women who did experience the intervention versus the women who did not, it's very interesting, because for cesarean section and labor induction, it's about 3 times more women who experienced the intervention had also experienced pressure to have it. So that's a very troubling find, and one that raises a lot of questions for why these women are feeling pressured. We did not find that with epidural analgesia, so that's another question. Why does that not apply? Another interesting finding is that for VBAC, it's almost sort of reversed, you know. So for those who did not have the intervention, when it comes to repeat cesarean, what that means is that they had a VBAC. And they're feeling, and even though they have the VBAC, they're still feeling a lot of pressure to have a a repeat cesarean. So as Christina mentioned, some of the barriers to VBAC, pressures from a provider is definitely being experienced by a lot of women to not have the VBAC. And so that was the last slide was just from the last most recent survey. So this is looking at pressure since 2005. And it's basically all either gone up or stabilized. So that is troubling. It is not something we want to see. And with the next slide, I think it makes it especially interesting because it somewhat conflicts with women's changing attitudes. Women are more likely than they were 10 years ago to agree or strongly agree with the statement that giving birth is a process that should not be interfered with unless medically necessary. And this probably has a lot to do with why we see rates of interventions either stabilizing or decreasing. However, what does this mean for women in their interactions with their provider? Are they feeling more pressure from their provider because their attitudes are changing, or are providers, or is there a difference in practice? You know, based on this information, it seems very well likely that providers aren't really changing, that they're doing the same thing that they've been doing for a while, but that women's attitudes changing, what they perceive is pressure from their provider to have these interventions that they're a lot less amenable to than they might have been 10 years ago. So in summary, we have increasing support for less intervention and the leveling off of most interventions, but despite this, there are still a lot of concerns that we need to address from a policy and research angle, decreased interest in breastfeeding, increased pressure to have induction, increased use of lithotomy, lying down, position in giving birth for vaginal birth, decline in spontaneous vaginal birth, and decline in availability of VBACs. So thank you very much, and also special thanks to Maureen Corey, Sandy Applebaum, and Carol Sakala, who were our co-authors on this report and integral members of our team.
Great team, wonderful panel, altogether wonderful. I don't know if there are questions. I'm going to actually ask Carol Nelson, my co-chair, to come up here and lead this discussion. She's going to be leading the next panel. Due to some excitement, I actually was elected to the executive board yesterday. I need to show up somewhere at noon, so I don't want to alter the conversation and definitely want to be part of it, but I want you all to have time to ask questions and get them answered. So Carol, I know, is taking over right after that. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Thank you all, and we look forward to trying to figure out what we're going to do next year as we go on to New Orleans. So we look forward to your suggestions.
Yeah, we're always looking forward to exciting topics that we can put in our call for abstracts. So anyone who has any ideas on that will be happy to take those.